insight and solutions, you're in for a unique experience. One where you're free to ask questions about where you're stuck, ask and hear questions of an everyday variety, global or personal, deep or ancient. All questions are welcome. Any human issue or problem is seen with a new awareness from Patricia's powerful understanding of whole brain thinking. Receive insights you never thought were possible, and be comforted to hear some insights you always knew were right. Discover the profound and the creative value that problems can give us. And now, Patricia's son.
Welcome to Trust the Problem. This is Patricia's son, and today on Trust the Problem, I'm going to be talking about the end of war. Something these days that seems impossible. Everybody's so stressed and so worried. The world is just heating up, and we have lots of irresponsible behavior everywhere and fear everywhere. And, of course, all of that is what creates war. But I believe, and have for many, many decades, that there's an evolutionary leap happening for the human race. And one of the characteristics of it is that there won't be war any longer, because from my point of view, war is a failure of human intelligence. And once we realize that, I think it'll only take a couple of decades before we completely unravel the psychology that causes war. Now, if that sounds all too idealistic and impossible, stay tuned, because I think it's doable. And I've thought this for some 35 years. I've been teaching about a new style of thinking. And this new style of thinking is really one of being able to see beyond duality, being able to be creative. Think outside the box is one way to say it. But actually, it's about really allowing inspiration, intuition, reality itself in. And what would allow that? What creates the space in the room for that to happen? Well, I think it is understanding and giving up denial. And to understand denial, people used to ask me years ago to write a book, but I'd have to call it denial, and then nobody'd read it. So you have to go gently, you have to go slowly, and I have been doing that for some 35 years. And I think now is a great turning point. I think we're right able to see, right in the midst of putting up the archetype that doesn't work right in front of us, all around us, while having had 30 years of ideas and words from many sources, many areas, coming forward from past history, way back to the time of the Greeks, lots of insight and revelation. So the words are there, though they are not mostly lived. And we're still in old-style thinking. So let me explain a little what old-style thinking is to me. Anyway, I made it up so I can make up the definition. Old-style thinking is what I call the either-or polarized simplistic approach to thinking itself, that the goal behind the simplisticness is to be right, that you have an emotionally conditioned agenda not to be wrong. And since we're all wrong, we all make mistakes, we all try something, it doesn't work, it's a mistake, you take it, that didn't fit, that doesn't work, that's a mistake. And mistakes are great. Mistakes are what teach us what doesn't work. As I think it was Henry Ford and Thomas Edison mixed up on this course. Thomas Edison. He said, you know, the man who's made 100 mistakes is 100 times ahead of the man who's made none, because he knows 100 things that don't work. And I would expand on that to say it's important not only to know what doesn't work, that's very valuable in itself, but to get some inkling why it doesn't work, which is what you usually discover when it doesn't work. And that's why making mistakes is not only valuable, it's essential. Let me say that again. Making mistakes is not only valuable for creative growth and growing and learning and discovery, it is essential. It is of the essence of it, because it stimulates the challenge to be inspired and to think think something never thought before, to think outside the box, to be inspired, to breathe in spirit, which is what inspire means. And you take in the spirit and you have a revelation, you have an aha, you have an epiphany, an intuitive hit, or even just a sense, something else has to be looked at here because this doesn't quite fit. And so you're open to look some more, which is what respect means. It means receive, look again, take another look. And so when we respect life and we respect the process, and we know that the process is the means by which we grow and heal and discover, then we are thinking in new style thinking. Old style thinking actually doesn't like process. And unfortunately, I just heard our president say just yesterday or the day before that he's not interested in process. He's only interested in winning. Well, winning what? And what defines winning? And how do you ever get there anyway, except through a process? And if you don't attend to the process, you are robbed of all the solutions that are healing, that are healthy, that are beyond our wildest dreams in the direction of goodness. So old-style thinking doesn't like process, just wants to win, thinks black and white, win or lose. And when you think in old-style thinking, and I would say that the origin of old-style thinking is that we're conditioned as children, as well as we're mature when we're children, and we tend to think a little more simplistically, but we're more earnest, we're more honest, we're more open-minded. But that earnestness and that open-mindedness gets put down by humiliation from the adults around us, people around us, by either being ridiculed or even physically hurt for seeing what's really happening. Because one of the things that makes old-style thinkers become vicious is if you reveal, and especially if you do it innocently but clearly, you reveal that they are wrong, that they have made a mistake, because it's the one thing they can't stand. They can go through an elaborate thing of, oh, I made a mistake once and this is it, and so I'm not afraid of looking at a mistake. They can do that. Everybody can do that. But energetically, actually, living in the moment, the problem is we are humiliated and we are angry at ourselves for having made mistakes, which is so sad because, as I said before, it's the essential part of creativity and learning and growing and getting a feel for what's good. You try this. Well, part of it felt okay, but something didn't feel good. Or I did this and it got this bad reaction. I wonder what else I need to know. When we think like that, we're new style thinkers. We're thinking outside of the linear, I need to win, I need to be right box, which is what I call old style thinking. And it causes war because you're for us or against us, as both President Bush and Osama bin Laden both said in the same week, right after 9/11. And it's simplistic thinking, and it always causes you to kill the innocent, to hurt. It's ideological thinking. Because simplistic thinking needs ideology. It likes ideology, because then you just have to pay attention to the ideology, not reality. Not if you're actually killing babies and families, innocent villagers that don't have anything to do with what you're upset about. And when you can do that, when you are thinking that anybody who doesn't agree with you or doesn't support you even further is an enemy, because then you can do anything. Then you can spy on them, then you can imprison them, then you can torture them, because, after all, they're not for you. Well, that's simplistic thinking. And you might think, well, that's kind of taking it to extremes, but yes, that's what it tends to do. And the more collectively we allow it, the more collectively we don't have the insight to see that it is an extreme, we fall into a chain reaction. And and a chain reaction that devolves and is cruel and swats tiny mosquitoes with not even sledgehammers, with bulldozers. So it reminds me, when I say that, of a quote by Martin Luther King, who said, "The chain reaction of evil, wars producing more wars, must be broken, or we shall plunge into a dark abyss of annihilation." It's a lot like what Gandhi said about an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and his experience just leaves us blind and toothless. And of course, all of this comes from what Jesus and Buddha taught. Buddha before Jesus, Jesus in the Middle East. And Jesus brings so much love into it, and realizing that love was the thing that made a change. That when you, and what, by saying that, it's not about the words, it's not about the rules, it's not about the ideology, it's about living energetically, living and feeling the truth behind what the words should mean. And what people have done these days in their need to be right is they hear good words that are resonantly, obviously true, and they say them with anger, like a stick, and beat people over the head with it. And of course, that's missing the whole point. And this happens on all sides. All sides. Anything you could think of, all sides. Because when there are sides, it's because somebody has agreed to the polarization that there are sides. When in fact, there really are no sides. And that's why I made this t-shirt that I have with the logo. And the logo is my trademark now. And it is, "You can't take sides when you know the earth is round." And it's a picture of the earth and the words travel around it. "You can't take sides when the earth is round." And half of the words appear upside down to you when you're wearing it. You look down and the opposite words seem upside down to the person looking at you. And of course, it's like each letter represents a person standing on a sphere, each standing upright, each thinking they see what they see, and they do. And what we really need to know is have respect to feel all the different points of view. And when we do, then we see that the earth is round, and we see there's a whole, and we see that we're really, literally, brothers and sisters, that there is no race, that racism is just a superficial categorizing of people, that, and I mean, I stress the word superficial, it's an appearances thing, and we can easily clump somebody into our projection, into our enemy box by color. So blacks do it to white, whites do it to blacks, Asians, Indians, you name any kind of group you want that's different physically looking. And one of the good things is that we've got it now to brown people. So that's a big bunch of people that used to fight each other. So that's kind of getting smaller. But it's all a silliness. If it weren't so horrible, the word would be very thin. It's just that it's so foolish. It's so blind to be racist of any sort, because it means somebody of a certain look hurt you. And then forevermore, people who look like that are enemies. I mean, isn't that really silly? I mean, so simplistic. But people do it all the time. And they do it culturally, against a different culture, against a different religion. And, of course, the other thing that's so fascinating is how the three monotheistic religions, the great three great religions that know God is one, God is all there is no other God but God. Those that know that, say they know that, don't get they're all talking about the same God. It always struck me as very strange, even when I was a little girl, 7, 8 years old, I think. Well, yeah, so what's the problem? So why are they doing all this? And it has to do with lots of other things, lots of other fears. And it, more than anything, my thesis, my contention is that it's a style of thinking problem. And that we're about to realize it collectively. And when we really realize it, I think it'll only take about 20 years. it will be seen as way too foolish, way too harmful, way too unnecessary, and actually an unbelievable thing to do. I remember years ago, some ad or something that said, think the unthinkable. And it was something about war. And I thought, unthinkable? That's all everybody thinks about. War is not unthinkable. War is more thinkable. War is the thing everybody thinks about. What's unthinkable is to imagine that there would be no war. And to imagine it in reality terms, that it is actually possible for us not to have war. That's the one we refuse to even consider. We say, well, it's unreasonable, it's irrational, it's not possible. And we refuse to allow it to have any room to come into being. And that's, again, old-style thinking. What new-style thinking does is it says, there's an injury here. Maybe many. Maybe many for many people. And what we do is we bit by bit acknowledge that, respect it, look at it, and do our best collectively to correct it. And wherever we can find consensus on something, we correct it. And then by attrition, the woundedness fades and things become healthier and we see each other in more real terms and more human terms. So simply put, that's one way. But the fact that there's going to be an end to war and that it's possible is that it is, I believe, built into our DNA. I often use the metaphor, which is an ancient metaphor, of the caterpillar turning into a butterfly. And I used to say, you know, what happens is the caterpillar goes, eats like crazy, takes in the world, and then he goes into this kind of state of stillness, where he lets nature turn his guts to soup, and nature realigns his being, and he comes out a butterfly. And I believe that we are just about ready, and this happens in cycles and stages, so it's not just one big thing. It happens in many stages within people all around the world at different times on different issues. But as we let go and we reflect and we surrender somewhat to God, to goodness, to healing, to inspiration, and we don't promote fear and we don't harm people and we notice when we're angry and revengeful feeling or even just irrationally don't like somebody, and we stop and we say, this means this is something in me that I'm projecting out because I can't bear to be wrong. And I'm only an innocent being. This is part of the fuel that you take in. And I'm going to look at this. I'm going to sit with this. I'm going to see what comes up. And then by a miracle, by magic, by nature, by God, by the order of the universe, we are transformed. Something else happens. This is nothing you can make happen. All you can do is let it happen. And I believe the human race is, by its DNA, by our nature, are potentially the butterflies. This is the kingdom of heaven on earth that we're supposed to pray for every day. This is the thing that we're supposed to allow to come into being as we forgive our trespasses, as we forgive those also who trespass against us. Forgive both. See it. See both. And don't let yourself go into temptation, tempted to be just erratic, just escapist, just angry. Pause and reflect. And that delivers you from the craziness, the evil, the repetitiveness of the cycle. So we are in the midst of an evolutionary leap, I believe, and this is built in. So the good news is, you just have to work on the little piece of the planet you're sitting in. because this is the one you have free will over. This is the one that your responsibility, your ability to respond, is built into you. And it's not about blame. Responsibility is not about blame. Responsibility is about the power to respond, and to respond in a healthy way. That's empowerment in the direction of the unfolding of life. And that's what we call good. Goodwill. Goodness. And so when we allow ourselves to reflect, to self-heal, to self-correct, we transform the piece of the planet that we are sitting in. And it is this piece of the planet that, when you bring love into it, you bring God into it. You bring a radiance. You bring a power that radiates from you. It comes out of you. It's not intellectual about words. We have reached the point in the world where the good words are here. They're just being spoken falsely. They're being spoken with the energy missing, without the love, without the real transformation. And it's very interesting, because that's the point. And I think we're almost being set up. It's like the analogy that came to mind, it's a little gory, but it's like pus out of a wound. It's like this giant abscess, and it's building and building, and we keep trying to cover it over like it's not there. But really, we have to let the pus come out of the wound. What is pus? Pus is white cells that have given their lives trying to bring health and heal the breach and heal the injury and gobble up the toxins that are hurting you. And all it pus is those white cells. But if we try to cover it up, then it infects further and can kill the whole being, the whole person. But as Justice Brandeis said, sunlight is the best disinfectant. So the light of day, the light of consciousness, on the wound, as we clean it and care for it and are tender, allows nature, the order of the universe, our DNA, to self-correct and to heal. It's very interesting. We really don't know what causes wounds to heal. We know what prevents them from healing. We know we can help them heal by getting those things that injure more out of the way, like having things clean, stitching things up to give tissues an advantage to bind back together. But we don't really know what makes it go back together. We do not know what created life. We do not know what makes a one-celled zygote separate and become a human being. We don't know. We really don't. We know what it does now more than ever before, but we don't know what makes it do that. And what I would say is that's what God is. God is the name for all that is not sayable, that is the order of the universe and is all that is. And when we have a kind of more relaxed attitude, but more expansive and more loving attitude about that, then we interestingly get right to the core of the three monotheistic religions, and we begin to practice what they preach. But instead, we dwell on the ideologies, on the blaming, on the projection, because projection is really the big killer. I mean, this is the one that really makes us hurt so many people. I just heard the president today, this morning, say, he's talking, well, you can guess what he's talking about. I think he's talking about himself and the neocons and anyone who thinks that we need to have war. He says, an extremist group of folks run by ideology and willing to use terror to gain political goals. An extremist group of folks run by ideology and willing to use terror to gain political goals. Who uses terror? Who is interested in political goals? Who has an ideology? Who is extremist? And you know, you might make a case in certain issues, we all are somewhere, sometime. but it has risen to an extreme, simplistic, kind of foggy denial mode, where you cannot point out something that doesn't work because you're accused of criticizing, attacking, hating, when that's all projection. Criticism, attacking, and hating are old-style thinking, but critiquing and seeing and saying without hating, with understanding there, but for the grace of God go I, and sometimes probably do, that's a different place. It's just saying, this didn't work, this isn't good, this isn't helpful, or this is the process that appears to be going on. And then there's not a hatred process. There's a release that there is process, because there all things can be made new in process. And that's the next level of thinking, and that's new style thinking. It thinks beyond reality, it allows, it perceives, it says, and it is motivated energetically, in fact, in reality, with a loving spirit, with a goodwill towards men. And when there is that goodwill, all things are changed. And when there is not goodwill, all things polarize and become angry and hurtful. It's an exacerbation. It makes it worse. And so, it's not that hard, actually, to endure. And the good news is, you really only have to work on yourself. And what happens is, collectively, we kind of get lost in the struggle. And we get addicted to the aggressive energy. Because when you feel aggressive and angry, it blanks out, it blocks out all our guilt, all our responsibility, all the things we have done, all the things we have not done. It helps us, like a drug, escape, numb out. But just like a drug, it causes us to do harmful things, and then there's more guilt, so then there's more aggression, and more projection, and more hate. And we're addicted to aggressiveness and polarized thinking because it's distracting. And also, just like a drug gives you a hit of relief and makes you feel better, polarized thinking gives you a relief, makes you feel better because you're right, they're wrong. And that's why we need projection, because there's no room to keep seeing what you're doing that's wrong. And of course, that's where you miss all the pay dirt. That's where you miss all the beauty, power of this wonderful setup. You miss what it is you can gain wisdom from. You miss what you can correct in your physical body. It's your soul transforming the world, one body at a time. Your body. You transform your body. I transform my body. And then we are closer and closer, as we transform, to healing. To being healing, to having love genuinely felt. And it is the good news about all this is that it's actually doable, and there's no real enemy except our resistance to let go and be the next level, or our fear, our immaturity. That's like saying, you know, the enemy of the three-year-old, because he can't drive a car, is that he's three. You know, we're three-year-olds sometimes. We're not able. Sometimes we're 30 years old, but we've been kept in a room for 30 years. And so we come out pretty crippled, pretty handicapped. But even then, it's possible by experimenting, by trying. That's why innocence is so beautiful, so compelling, so delicate, such a treasure to see innocence in someone. And the good news is you never lose innocence. You only deny it. It's always there. There's people who we see who are not innocent, and they are acting out of having, really, I believe, feelings of humiliation about their innocence. So they stomp it down. They try to run away from it, become cynical and harsh. And polarized And that's so that they can avoid feeling the grief of their innocence injured. But innocence is a great power. It is the place of openness to that goodwill, that flow, that spirit in the universe that matures us and heals us and sets us free and gives us ideas and creates heaven on earth. We learn to follow that flow and be creative and create things never done before. We're not then worried about security because we literally now trust in God. People don't trust in God. In fact, the people who will most often talk about it, although nobody talks about it really anymore, they argue whether it should be on the money or not. But nobody really trusts anymore. It's everybody's so busy in the addiction of aggression. And the other thing, the other component about ending war is, so that was about the style of thinking, which permeates everything, by the way. It is the issue. It's not the issues. The issues are all dysfunctional in a context of how we think. So it's just the thinking that's the problem. How we think, how we sort information, our emotional defenses. And so as I said just briefly before, too, is that we have our immaturity as children, and then we have our conditioned treatment, the way that people who are older treat us and laugh at us and make fun of us or hurt us or ridicule us for being innocent, for being open. And adults do that to children because it's very painful to them to actually see that innocence. It reminds them of their own innocence. And they can't bear that. That becomes painful. And so this, instead of processing themselves and working on themselves, it's easiest just sort of beat up on the kids or ridicule someone who's being inspiring, which is why we've, you know, always persecuted our prophets, because they were even great thinkers like Galileo or Copernicus, people who knew something real about the world that didn't fit with the ideology of the time, and sort of in their view weakened it. So they had to be persecuted. This is us. This is the devastation. This is the suffering that humanity has had for as long as we've been humanity. And we've gone through cycles up and down, up and down. I think of the golden age of Greece when we had democracy. It's a Greek word. Pericles and the golden age. And we had beautiful art and great architecture and science. And so they coined the word atom. They knew there was something smaller that could be not seen. They knew the Earth was round. They knew there was a solar system. They had so much information. And then the kind of linear thinking, they were very yin at that brief time, didn't last long. and then there was like all roads lead to Rome, and there's linear and vis-a-vis in our legal system, and you have to win. And adjudicate is just about deciding. It's not about justice. It's not about truth. It's not about honesty. It's not about goodwill. It's not about making things healthy or whole. It's about arguing and winning. And as long as that's true, it's not always true, thank goodness. There's a lot of holistic lawyering going on now and win-win kind of adjudication. And that's good. And it's all, like, the seeds are all about us. They're all about us. It is the collective shift that's needing to come into being. And so I was thinking about energy. This is now segueing into the other component that creates war, the economic part, the energy part, the physical energy part. You know, in past centuries and cultures, it was really always about slavery. It was making people into the source of power by a smaller group to dominate, to control. And not only slavery, black-white slavery, black-black slavery, but the kind of slavery that used to be called peasants, all through medieval Europe, Soviet Union, China, all the rest of the world, really. What we called the peasants, or the common people, were really slaves. They were owned by a lord, had life and death control over them, who took their labor, who directed them. And this shift from having to live like that to having a real democracy where everyone has a niche, where everyone can do something. This is Jesus' idea. And I must say, Karl Marx did say, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need, which was based on Christian thought, Jesus' message, that communism has never done that. You know, far from it. It became another ideology, just like the Middle Ages and the Inquisition. Far from what Jesus taught, not it. We have a real problem living the goodness because, basically, we feel insecure. We feel fearful. And the people who dominate are people who feel the most scared and who want to have money, want to have power, and want to dominate. And the issue right now in the world, both with global warming, basically attacking the whole ecosystem of the planet, is the burning of fossil fuels and other chemicals into the atmosphere. All of this, global warming, the pollution, the lung disease, the difficulty of not having enough, or who has it, and who's making a lot of money on it, certainly caused the war in Iraq. The whole Middle Eastern thing is contaminated by the influence of this other greed that wants the power of the oil. Well, what if I would say that in about 5 or 10 minutes, I could totally explain why we don't need any oil to run our cars anymore, ever, or any machinery or energy? We just don't need it. We totally wouldn't need it, that we have available right now everything we need to create energy in abundance that causes no pollution. See, nobody would believe it. Already I can hear the minds closing. Not possible, not possible. But consider this. I probably recommend this on the radio show about seeing the movie Who Killed the Electric Car. First, if we went, which I understand was the first car, was electric. It wasn't gas run. It was electric steam, I think. But anyway, so you have an electric car that doesn't have an internal combustion engine, so it has all those parts not there. So it's quiet, has less to break down. It doesn't burn anything, so there's no smell, nothing. It's silent, it's fast. You can design it any way you want to look as great as you want. Go on the internet, I've forgotten the name, Vesta or something like that. It's Italian electric car, it's absolutely gorgeous. And they're starting up this electric car. And they're going to be, you know, whoever starts making electric cars can be ahead of the curve. They're going to be the next Bill Gates, because this is what we need. And then people say, oh, well, batteries are toxic, it costs more to generate, you know, you make more pollution at the power plants, making the electricity for the cars. I'll get to that in a second. Just want to say, all the infrastructure for electric is already here. What you would do is, at night, when you came home from work, you plug in your car, overnight it would charge, in the morning you'd go to work, there'd be a place you could plug, if you drove more than, you know, 50, 75 miles to get to work, you could plug it in while you're at work and then charge it again. Batteries that are getting better and better and better to hold longer and longer charges are being evolved and designed as we speak. So the infrastructure is simple. It would cost less than about 3 cents, you know, the equivalent of a gallon's worth of mileage. It would be about 3 cents. So you would have the whole thing cheaper, easier, cleaner, right there with electric cars. So now we'll go to the problem of getting fuel, getting the energy, the electrical energy that's not polluting. So you don't need to use oil or coal. You could use hydrogen at the power plant. You wouldn't have to use nuclear power plants, because nuclear power plants, when they melt down or explode, contaminate the world for, 27,000 years and cause mutations and cancer and all kinds of pollution that is of the most extraordinary, horrible kind. So we don't need power plants, nuclear power plants. We need power plants. We don't need coal or oil or any other type except hydrogen. Now, hydrogen is combustible, so not very good to make hydrogen cars because, first of all, you have to build the whole infrastructure. So let's say we have 170,000 gas stations around the world, and we've got to build all these hydrogen hydrogen stations, and they're flammable, and they could explode, and hard to get the stuff to the gas station and all of this. Not a good plan. Plus, it's not built yet, and you'd have to build it and cost a lot of money. So then, what if we had wind turbines out at sea on a flotilla that was there weren't people there, there weren't birds, it wasn't bothering anybody. You could use computer analysis of winds to put the floating turbines in exactly the right location to get the right effective amount of wind for the turbine. The turbine would generate the electricity, and in part of this flotilla, you would have a hydrogen processing plant. It does cost energy to turn water into hydrogen. Hydrogen is the most common element in the universe, and water is made up of oxygen and hydrogen. So we are at sea, you've got water, you can convert it with the electricity, you turn it into hydrogen, you condense it into liquid hydrogen. You have boats, instead of oil tankers, you have hydrogen tankers come in, take the hydrogen to the ports, specified ports where the hydrogen power plants could be. And then you create the electric grid going out from the power plants. And the power plants, the worst that could ever happen to them is that they could blow up. If they blew up, they would burn, but they would not contaminate the earth. And, of course, it's easier to control and understand than having everybody with hydrogen in their car and hydrogen stations everywhere. That would be much more hazardous. This would be contained, be converted into electricity. We would be using the natural wind and weather and power of the sun and the earth. Plus, we could have solar voltaic panels on top of cars so that if you parked out in the sun, keep your car cooler and your battery be charged. So there's so many ways. I mean, that's just a little, tiny, little setup where it's a closed circle, no more pollution. We're using the sun and the nature and the energy of the earth. And this is just a solution. It's so doable. It's so easy. But people will not let themselves even think about it because the people who are in power are making lots and lots and lots of money by having the stress of oil and the issue of oil. And they want to keep control over the system, whether they're making cars that use gas or whatever, or they are the processors or whatever they're doing. They want to keep the power. And that's only because they can't imagine, they can't envision it, because they have denial. Denial about what they have done. Denial about what they have done. About the harm to the earth. About their fears of being powerless and not having money. And not being in control. It is also immature. It's also old-style thinking. It's all simplistic and not simple. There's a difference between having something be simple and doable and real. And simplistic thinking, which categorizes, forces reality to be made, reduced into just simple poles. And put into poles so you can be on one side that's right and the other person can be on the other side that's wrong. So you can be right and they can be wrong. That's what causes war. Because if you just keep sticking to your ideology and your simple think, then you are going to have anxiety, anger, hatred, fear, because at some level you know it isn't true. And that's when you start projecting onto others And that's when you start saying they're extremists. And that's when you say they're run by an ideology. And that they're willing to do the unconscionable, to use terror to gain political ends. And that's why we have to change, by seeing, not by blaming. My goodness, if you really stop to think about polarized thinking, there's probably nobody alive on the planet who hasn't done it and who doesn't have certain areas where they're still stuck doing it. That's not the problem. The problem is being attached to doing it. That we do it is inevitable. The thing that I'm speaking of isn't intellectual as much as it is energetic. It's about honesty, authenticity, heart, goodwill, and willingness to see, to relax and trust that there is a God, that it's unfolding as it should. All these people who say they trust in God and, you know, go out killing. No, that's not trusting in God. And all these people who hate other people because they have only one God, but it's not your one God. Excuse me? That always struck me very silly. I don't even know why it doesn't strike people. It's just very strange. But the whole point is that we are in the midst of an evolutionary leap. We really are being set up by having all these archetypal examples all around us. It's getting so silly, so much denial, so much suffering, immediately reported, shown, distorted, but still right there. We all know at some level what we're doing. I have some quotes on war. And I don't know who General Smedley Butler is. But he said, "War is a racket. It always has been. It is possibly the oldest, easily the most profitable, surely the most vicious." And it is a racket. It's a way to cover your tracks, get everybody riled up so that they're not paying attention to what's really happening. And the other point is one that Edward R. Murrow made, which is that we must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. When the loyal opposition dies, I think the soul of the country dies with it. And wars do not, as somebody named W. L. George, I don't know who he is either, but he said, "Wars teach us not to love our enemies, but to hate our allies." I've heard that one before. But anyway, the thing is that loving your enemy does something. That's why it was so powerful. That's why, you know, the energy of Jesus still is here, still lingers, because, it's, in fact, in some ways it's stronger than ever, because it shows up the hypocrisy everywhere, without a word, without an attack, without judgmentalism, or anything like that. It just is love shining. And when you say you love Jesus, you love God, and you want to kill somebody, and you say, "Oh, well, I have to," be a little suspicious of whether that's true. Consider it deeply before you sit sucked into that. And another quote that I don't have written here, but I remember, is one by Rudyard Kipling. And he said, it's a little sentence, he said, "When they ask why we died, tell them that our fathers lied." And this is so deep, so poignant, because it is at the very core of how we love one another, our families, how we injure our children, how we don't mean to often, and sometimes we do mean to. And why would we do things like that when we also truly do love them also? And my experience is that that comes from this style of thinking. It's judgmental. It's too terrible to be so wrong. So the anger and the hatred flares out against the weaker, the more innocent. And we do it to people and children who look good, who are smart. there's a kind of a special kind of hate reserved for envy and resentment, because it's really about self-hate, so it's deeply right to the core generating, and it's kind of really ruthless. And it's what makes it so hard in times of fear to tell the truth. George Orwell said, and of course his 1984 was very prophetic, because it's an archetype of what human beings have been doing for hundreds of thousands of years. Well, not hundreds of thousands, thousands. Only been here probably about not even 100,000 years. So we're so young. We're so new. But anyway, George Orwell said, in times of universal deceit, which is truly what we are, where we are now, so much deceit, in times of universal deceit, telling the truth will be a revolutionary act. Well, yeah, except the way you transcend that is to tell the truth with love, to tell it gently. Then you're helping people hop out of that polarizing dance, because you're not making them the enemy. You're making our own collective immaturity our dysfunction, and there is no enemy. The only enemy is our fear. The only enemy is our immaturity and our stubbornness, our unwillingness to surrender to what is good. And to see how that works, you know, we all know you get humiliated sometimes, you get ganged up on. But what I found is that the more clearly, that gives you practice, because that when you get jumped on, you tend to want to go back to the old way, jump back, right? Well, that's why Jesus said, when you get hit, turn the other cheek. He didn't really mean go around, get beat up. He didn't mean be a doormat. He was trying to express a point where try again. Try love again. Try it another way. Come from a different direction. It's not about being a victim, because that's not loving. That's not you loving you. It's not a kind thing to be a victim. And you are able, response able for you. And so you want to take good care of you. You want to love you. You want to be kind so you can have the openness of mind to be a healing person to yourself and other people. This is a change in consciousness, and it doesn't always feel comfortable. It feels comfortable to just be reactionary, and you don't have to think. It's like it feels more comfortable to take a drug. It takes more comfortable to just be angry. It's more comfortable to just take a cigarette than to stop and go through the discomfort of facing the backlog of that the drug has helped you cover. And meanwhile, while you were covering up with the escapism of the drug, you know, whether it's money, oil, or it's anger and blame, or it's cigarettes, or it's cocaine, or it's alcohol, when you start to stop taking the drug, you're left with not only the familiarity of the not having to face yourself, push it on somebody else, but you are faced with an onrush of grief, not only for who you really are and from your judgmental style of thinking, way overly judgmental to yourself, but not only that, but you're faced with the sadness that you've been harmful. And it sometimes seems too much to bear. And I want to say, wow, it's not too much to bear. It's wonderful. It is ultimate freedom. It is healing. And the peace that says it's too much to bear is a style of thinking that's judging you so harshly that it's not giving you the opportunity to be a human being in a creative mode, moving from the mistakes of immaturity to the wisdom of making mistakes and learning from them and becoming wise and experienced. That's all you're doing. Why rob yourself of that with an added blow? And this is how we shift. I remember when Al Gore gave one of his talks that I was at about an Inconvenient Truth before the movie, and he said the sad thing about global warming is that first people are in denial about it. They don't want to hear about it. And then when they begin to realize, and the facts start seeping in, and they realize it's true and the magnitude of it, then they move quickly to despair. And that's old-style thinking. And I said to the guys that produced his talk, you know, I said, if you ever need me to talk, because what I do is I expand the space between the denial and the despair. And that's what new-style thinking does. It expands the space from denial to despair. And we must focus on that. That is what creates the end of war. That is what allows us to make the evolutionary leap. The very thought, when you notice you're perhaps in denial, and then certainly when you leave the denial and you get a flood of remorse, or you feel very bad, or you stop drinking and you feel very bad, and you start to remember all the harm you've caused because you were drinking, or if you're a dry drunk, you see you've been being grandiose and leading people perhaps you even care about into harm's way a lot. And when you see that, instead of slamming yourself, you say, ah, this is what humanity must face, and I am no less than anybody else. This is what we must face. I remember when I first heard to become whole. I remember when I first heard two ancient Chinese proverbs, everyone you meet is your mirror, and you become what you resist. They're 5,000 years old Chinese proverbs. And when I first heard it, I was so ripe to hear it that it was like a finger pointing right between my eyes. Every moment, every thought I had that was judgmental, and anybody I criticized, I immediately turned it into myself. And I remember being exhausted. It went on for about 3 months. And I remember thinking, thank God nobody can read my mind yet. Because this is terrible. This is exhausting. Well, the truth is we all can read each other's mind. We just either go into the collective agreement that we can't, or we start to heal. And then spontaneously we find the joy and the beauty and the wonder and the healing of being able to read each other deeply. And when we have goodwill for one another, it's heaven on earth. That is where we're going. That is what we long for. And of course, very precisely, that is why all of our problems are our treasures. They are signposts about something infinitely better. Something more wonderful. So when you have a problem in a relationship, with an addiction, with the world at large, you still begin to know that really what's up is that you're about to heal, you're about to mature, you're about to look at this with whole new eyes that gives you a calm wisdom and say, hey, this is the boat that humanity's in, and I realize it, and I'm working. This is how we relieve ourselves from the frantic fears. And we cannot be then steamrolled into wars. And we will transform ourselves and thereby the world. Because the good news is, and the easier it is for people to receive and to see. So you just become a healer by healing yourself. So thank you so much for joining me and being with Trust the Problem. I'm Patricia Sun, and I invite you back again and come see my website and learn some of the other things that I'm doing. Much love.
You've been listening to Trust the Problem with Patricia Sun. This program and its content is copywritten to Patricia Sun, all rights reserved, 2006.